Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Good day. We're back. It's the Apparatus Architects, the now retired Lieutenant Michael Wilbur and Tom Shand, your Apparatus Architects. We're back on the radio. We'd like to thank our host, Peter Matthews, after a long absence, not due to anything in particular. So whatever the rumor control was that the lieutenant was out on an extended cruise retirement, he was out in Bora Bora somewhere, looking to renegotiate the contract like one of these Major League Baseball players. To our loyal listeners, all of that's patently false. We're down here holding the fort, and we're just real happy to be back. So our podcast news today, we're going to just do a quick little rundown here for 10 or 15 minutes of some recent news, things that have been happening as a result of Michael's and my traverses across these great United States. Then we're going to finish up the show and talk a little bit about 2014 in the apparatus industry. What do we see going on? What are the trends? What's good, the good, bad, and ugly, and kind of talk about that a little bit. Most importantly, for all of our loyal listeners and folks that have been following us over the years that we're very appreciative of, I want to remind everybody that the Firehouse Expo in Baltimore is coming up in the middle of July. We'll kick off on Thursday, the 17th of July, though the 17th, 18th, and 19th. Brother Mike and I will be putting on a couple of programs together with Mike, doing another program, and hopefully we'll be pulling off possibly taping a podcast there. So please come out and support the Firehouse Expo. We'll be there as together a lot of industry notables. Mike and I don't put ourselves under the category of notables, but we appreciate the support and to our loyal listeners. And again, we're just real happy to be back. So, Mike, hey, since some things going on here, most people are aware of that going back more than several weeks ago, America LaFrance down in South Carolina announced that they were rather quickly, I might add, as it came out from rumor control to it actually happening, they were closing the doors and basically have filed their, you know, doesn't appear now that they're going to reorganize in any fashion, that they're closing, and it's going to be somewhat of a difficult road for those people that not only, you know, were very loyal to the product, as with some other manufacturers, but supported the company. And if you've bought one of those devices, pieces of apparatus in the last, you know, 3 to 5, even 8, 10 years, and you're hoping to get 15 or 20 out of it, and we've already heard from a number of folks that parts are extremely difficult to come by, if you can get them at all. If folks are out there are having issues, we encourage you to just, as they would say in the political circles, you need to stay the course. Most folks are not in a position to just go out and go get rid of the rig to go buy a new one because the rig's 3 or 4 or 5 years old. But that unfortunately is kind of sad. No matter what you thought of the product or how you may have been treated by those folks with something that you had purchased in the past, certainly one of the longtime legacy names in the apparatus industry, it appears now is going to go down the road much the same as apparatus builders that Mike and I cut our teeth on back in the day of Maxim and Hahn and Peter Persch and just a lot of companies. So this one just was kind of a standalone item that, you know, it wasn't due to any particular, you know, overall financial issues that were going on with the industry, unlike what happened in the late 80s and early 90s. So, Mike, your thoughts on that, and maybe you can take us to, I know we can't cover them all, but we certainly have been doing a less than admirable job in keeping our rigs on the street here. So what have you got for us that you want to talk about?
Thanks, Brother Tom, and hi, everybody. It, Brother Tom, it's good to be back on the radio again. With American LaFrance, Tom and I had been saying for any number of months since the Great Depression of 2008 or fiscal decline of our country, and certainly a decline in the apparatus industry, that something had to give. The reality is, ladies and gentlemen, that prior to 2008, this country consumed 5,500 fire trucks. And with that said, last year, the industry struggled to build 3,100. Well, good common sense will tell you that if 80 builders were trying to build 5,500 trucks and sustain themselves with profitability, that those same 80 builders trying to build 3,100 trucks, that there just wasn't enough volume there to sustain all those people. Certainly, and American LaFrance has been teetering on the brink for some time now. Reality is that it was a fine, a good company, and it is truly sad. Like Tom said, like the Hans and the Peter Pershes and the Maxims and the Max, to see them go. That's the bad news. What could potentially be worse is, certainly in my opinion, and I think Brother Tom would echo it as well, that there's a very good likelihood that they're going to be joined by others, because although fire truck sales are getting better, I don't think there's anybody that has any kind of euphoria in mind to think that we're going to attain 5,500 trucks anytime in the near term. And so with that said, it's going to be less than 5,500 trucks a year. And I certainly don't believe that the industry is going to be able to sustain the number of builders that are still left. So I think when you purchase apparatus, certainly all the things that we recommend, like a Dun & Bradstreet, get a financial prospectus on your builder, make sure that you have bid bonds and performance bonds, all those things are still applicable, as I think that the industry is still in a good degree of turmoil, and it hasn't settled out yet from the fiscal decline. And I think that we need to be aware of that. So,
well, Mike, what's one or two of the recent accidents or things you want to highlight? And even though the rig may have been, somewhat torched, there's somewhat of a good side or success story because of folks wearing seatbelts.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. A really good friend of mine, Steve Pegram, he's a chief in Goshen Township in Ohio. It's near Cincinnati, Claremont County. They had a accident last night with significant apparatus damage. The bad news is it certainly looks like the rig sustained heavy damage and, could even potentially be a total loss. But with that said, everybody was seated and belted in, and they walked away with no injuries. And Steve is also a good friend of Chief Billy Goldfeder, and I know that he believes strongly in the use of seatbelts, and he's a very good fire chief. And our thoughts and prayers go out to those folks as they try to pick up the pieces from this accident. It occurred on the way back from a run. It was on a very narrow road. It had a big, deep side ditch. And anybody that's been in the eastern two-thirds of our country know that for the last week we've been under attack by Mother Nature and the weather, and there's been tremendous amounts of rain. And I think you put all that together, and that could certainly be many causative factors for that accident. Bad news is the truck is probably toast. The good news is that everybody was belted in and they walked away. And, you know, something that we've been preaching here for years, you know, folks, seatbelts work. They just do. It may not be the best in some trucks to put on. It may not be fashionable, but ultimately, at the end of the day, they do work, and we would really appreciate it if you'd put your seatbelts on. In another incident in Springfield, Illinois, a major traffic tie-up on Interstate 55 near Sherman after a fire truck blew a tire and crashed. And again, one of the things that we keep finding out over and over again over the class over the past several years have been overweight trucks. Now, of course, I'm here in New York, and this is in Illinois, and there's no way to discern that. But certainly when you start getting into brake issues and tire issues, one would certainly have to visit the weight of the vehicle, because that could potentially be a root cause. And that vehicle looked like to be a 75-foot Pierce Quint, rear-mounted Quint, and that thing looked like it was completely destroyed as well. And another problem that we've seen that's perennial, a motorist was killed after their vehicle was struck by a Michigan firefighter who was responding in his personal vehicle. It occurred in mid-April in the state of Michigan, and it was reported at 8:25 in the morning. He was in a line of northbound traffic, and he attempted to make a U-turn in front of the volunteer firefighter. And it's my belief that in the state of Michigan, volunteer firefighters can use their POVs, and many of them are granted emergency vehicle status and get the use of lights and sirens. So another a perennial problem in our business with POVs and civilian drivers not paying attention or doing things that we don't expect them to do. And then finally, in Elmwood Park, New Jersey, a fire captain had a blood alcohol content of 2.5 times the legal limit when he was in a fire truck crash while returning from a call. The unit was visibly swaying after the engine slammed into several utility poles. Another firefighter in the rig had to be taken to the hospital with what appeared to be minor injuries. The engine was taken out of service, leaving the fire department one short in battling a motel blaze at a hotel fire that occurred right after. County police have charged the captain driver of the fire truck with assault by auto, DWI, and reckless driving. He was issued summonses and released to a responsible adult. And again, this is something that goes on more often than we care to admit. It's a plague, not only in the fire service, but in our society as a whole. Having on a personal level, with some of my family members heavily involved with alcohol and other substances, it's a tough deal. But the reality is everybody knows now you shouldn't drink and drive, and particularly a fire truck. You know, they're just in for lawsuits and everything else. I mean, this is beyond a catastrophe. And it's probably, for a fire chief, it's probably his worst nightmare come true, with the exception of maybe having a line of duty death, having a fire truck wreck involving the abuse of alcohol by his driver. Your thoughts, Brother Tom?
Yeah, Mike, I couldn't agree more. In a lot of departments where there is alcohol available for consumption within the building, I think it goes without saying that you can talk about the issue But if it's available there, you're almost like, to me, it's like putting the cookie jar down within reach of your five-year-old. You know, you can tell them no cookies until after mom makes dinner. If it's in within his reach, you're basically condoning the fact that it's okay to consume it, and you're making it available. It's just truly, truly sad that in today's society, with all of the things that are known about it, to make it available in the station and then have a situation like that, yeah, I don't know how a department comes back from a PR disaster like that. You better go out and get the likes of a Billy Goldfeder and Dave Statter and every good PR person you can to help you figure out a party line if you haven't figured it out ahead of time. It's pretty tough. Well, at any rate, switching up gears here, we're going to talk a little bit about what's going on in the industry here in 2014, and I'll just kick it off with this and then throw it a mic. If you think about all the attention that we have spent to addressing the past ills, you know, we're making up this scenario. We're replacing a 1988 pumper. In 1997, at the 9-year mark, you had to have it refurbed because you bought a steel body that was back in the day. People were transitioning from steel water tanks to all the poly and fiberglass tanks we use today. And you had to do kind of like a midlife rehab because unexpectedly the unit started to rust from the obvious areas, from what you saw. You got some rust in the jump seat in the bucket area, a couple of compartment doors no longer lined up. You found out that maybe they used some inferior metal somewhere along the line. That's what everybody was doing back then. You shrug your shoulders, you suck it up, and now it's time to go buy a new rig. Well, if you look at somebody's, I'll call it 5 to 10-year-old fire truck today, where the body was made of aluminum or potentially stainless steel, hopefully you had a matching substructure of aluminum or stainless steel. And you look at the top side, you look around the rig of what you would wash and what you'd wipe down after coming back from a run, and everything appears to be dandy. You don't see any visible rust, maybe a little bubbling and blistering, you know, and some paint, but hey, you know, get over that, and the rig's potentially going to get you down the road another 5 or 7 years without having to sink money into it. Until such time that you decide to get on a creeper, and while Mike and I have preached incessantly about weighing your rigs, this is the next area that we see, that you go underneath the unit and find out your chassis frame rails, possibly, cross members, because they're attached to the chassis frame rails, and good chance that back in the day you just had it painted, whatever, didn't even think about what color you painted the frame rails. It came in 3 different shades, as Henry Ford would say, black, black, and black. And you start inspecting some of the components underneath and find out, wow, I've got some rust and corrosion situations here, and while my body on the top side, what you see as you walk around and do a 360 around your rig, looks good, you get underneath and find out it's not looking too good. And that has frankly been Mike's and my experiences with some departments, including some that take very, very good care of their apparatus. They have a very good outside the department preventative maintenance program where they contract with folks and they take care of this. And yet you come in and the rig is suffering from premature rust and corrosion, and now it's coming from the downside, not the top side. So, Mike, your thoughts on that? This is where the industry now is starting to go because they're recognizing this and they're going to address it, but if you've got any, no matter who made your rig, no matter what year it is, for our listeners, the rig could be 18 months old, it could be 18 years old, and we don't care whose nameplate is on the front, square, rectangular, or script. There's a reasonable chance you might have something going on underneath that you're not aware of. So, Mike, because you're part of the apparatus architects team that generally finds this stuff, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, Tom, it's funny. We'll go do an apparatus, a fleet evaluation, and sometimes we'll have a 1980 or 90 truck, and then we'll have a 2000 truck, and I would have to actually ask Tom what truck I'm under, because some of the newer trucks are rusting and going away at a far greater rate than some of the older trucks. A couple things for our listeners. we did an apparatus fleet inspection, and when we came up with our findings that a 2006 truck looked like it was 30 years old underneath, and told fire district officials, they were aghast because they were under the mistaken impression that when they sent their truck out for maintenance from a third party to do maintenance on the truck, that that was being checked. Your apparatus maintenance person, your preventive maintenance person, whoever you have, is only going to check those things that you list on a sheet to be checked. In another case, we went to a place where there was actually rust and brake dust on the floor from the braking system, and aghast to find out that we found that. Some of this stuff, to find it, is not necessarily hard. And then they exclaim, well, the guy just changed the tires. Yeah, but the guy changing the tires isn't in charge of looking at your brakes, and the problem was your brakes. So a word to the wise, when you do apparatus checks, you need to check the whole apparatus. And B, when you send it out for maintenance, you need to have a punch list or an itemized list of those particular areas or components that you want the maintenance facility to check as part of an annual truck inspection. If you don't tell them, they're probably not going to do it. As it relates to the frame rail rust that we found recently and rust in the substructure, it's just like building a house, folks. The house is only as good as the foundation. And we take it, some really good departments, I think, due to the lack of communication, really fell into kind of a pitfall here. They thought that they were doing the right thing by going out and purchasing a stainless steel body or an aluminum body and thinking that their corrosion issues have now been solved and that problem is going away, only to find the Mike and Tom show to come in to do a fleet evaluation, and we crawl under the rig and find out that the substructure built up off the frame rails isn't of aluminum or isn't of stainless steel, but is of just mild steel and is just basically rusting away like you can't believe. So from a specification point of view, we implore our listeners that if you are going to specify a stainless steel body, then you also need to specify and do due diligence by putting a stainless steel frame substructure on top of those big frame rails and on the underside of the body to hold it up. In like and kind, the same with aluminum. If you are specifying an aluminum body, then when you write your specifications, you need to also specify an aluminum substructure. Any words of wisdom with that, Tom?
Mike, I couldn't agree more. And on that subject, we're going to be talking more about that and putting on a program at the upcoming Firehouse Expo in Baltimore on this very subject, as well as in the maintenance track. A very good close friend of Mike's and mine, Don Gutchall, who is the maintenance supervisor for the township, Hamden Township, Pennsylvania, where he oversees not only fire trucks, but everything else that's got 4, 6, 8 or more tires going down the road. And Don, again, will be addressing that subject of things that you need to be thinking about doing at preventative maintenance for our listeners. There's a lot more than filter and oil change. You know, it's not like doing it on your car. Oil and filter change, lube the hinges, rotate the tires, and we're putting this thing back out on the street. So we'll be talking about that in a lot more detail in some upcoming shows, as well as a couple of the programs that will be on in Baltimore. So moving on, at the recent FDIC, arguably probably the second of many apparatus shows and conferences that happened during the course of the year, seems now to have moved it, just probably because of a timing standpoint of when it occurs,
It's one of the shows where a lot of the apparatus folks, as well as the component folks, introduce a lot of new products. And the Mike and Tom show, we walked around until our feet were almost worn out, and we needed new rubber on the soles to take a look at things. And I'll just start out and then let Mike chime in. A couple of impressions that I had. Because we're both kind of East Coast guys, we like looking at traditional engines and trucks. And in my estimation, that means it's a ladder truck that doesn't have a pump and tank on it, but has a heck of a lot of ground ladders and a lot of compartments to carry a lot of tools. And on the pumper side, nice short wheelbase, low hose bed, basic pumpers, something that just, it puts out fire. Not designed, not to disparage them, but it's not a rescue pumper. It's not a tech rescue, anything. It's a firefighting wagon. There were a couple of those out there, but the impression that I got is the industry is starting to address some of the issues we just talked about with respect to rust and corrosion, particularly in the frame rail areas, because they realize that's one of the few areas left that's rusting, but it's like the most important. A lot more technology with respect to compact fire pump packaging. For probably every rig that was out there that had a traditional side mount pump panel with traditional either crank or pull controls, there was a unit that was on display that was all electronic and by a touchpad about the size of an iPad. And while the one gentleman was taking me around a rig and showing me all the neat little things it did, I happened to inquire and said, well, what happens if this you punch this button and it doesn't work? Where's the manual override? And the fellow said, well, we're working on that. So the technology, again, you probably, if the listeners have figured out, that Mike and Tom, we're kind of like old school. We fully realize and appreciate electronics and technology is here. We're not going back to the days of mechanical engines and mechanical linkages and all that other stuff. But the one thing that I clearly came away with, Mike, to take away was much more electronics in the pump control area, compact pump panels in an effort to keep the vehicles from growing to be larger, and certainly predominated much more multi-purpose units. I can only think of maybe one or two traditional straight conventional ladder trucks that were there. They happen to be some demonstrator units. But overall, a lot of neat little new nuances of how to mount things in compartments, how things were laid out and controlled in the cab. Certainly much less, we've gone done a 360 from where we were back in early 2000s, which much more firefighter friendly and usable, if that's an appropriate term, inside the cab, less plastic, more metal. Number of people that even have gone to things that Mike have preached on with the seating placement so that you can safely seat people with the seat belts. And Mike, that was kind of like my takeaway. On the negative side, last thing, still saw a number of units with four, five, or in one case, six folding steps up the back of a rig to access a hose bed that's 90-some-odd inches in the ground, and they'll tell you it's NFPA compliant because there's a 3 points of contact and there's a handrail, and I'm just like, why in God's name with all the other things we've done can we not just let's take the folding steps. I got no skin in the game here. And let's provide safe access ladders and things up to the back. If you're going to design a rescue pumper and a hose bed's 80-plus inches in the air, don't rely, ladies and gentlemen, on folding steps and having somebody say, well, it meets the standard. You know, when somebody told me that, I was ready. Wilbur was going to have to roll me on the ground because my head hair was on fire. Mike, your shot.
Yeah, Tom. Some of the same takeaways, and we seem to, again, gravitate towards larger units that we try to do a little bit of everything with, and they're not necessarily good for much of anything when they get to the fire ground. And again, with staffing restrictions, you know, a lot of fire pumps on rescues, a lot of rescue pumpers, certainly a lot of quints that these just multi-purpose vehicles that once you start doing that, they just become larger and larger. They become tougher to drive. They become tougher to work off of. And although there were some glimmers of hope where there were some smaller units and some stray trucks, again, multiple units were certainly part of the day. It was refreshing to sit in a couple of the cabs of the truck, particularly at the officer's position, and the industry has finally started to realize that 18 inches for somebody in bunker gear to sit down safely and buckle in on a seat, or 22 inches, whatever it is now, the standard isn't big enough. And I really marveled when I sat in one particular truck in the back and listened to people get in the front and remark how much better it was and how much more room there was in the truck than previous trucks. And so the industry has done is doing a better job of laying out the cabs and trying to make allowances for seating and seat belts, as well as the engine packages and all the things that go into a modern day truck. With that said, there are still, again, many of the older designs where you need a shoehorn to try and get somebody in the front seat. Forget about whether they're dressed or not or putting a seatbelt on. It's just even tough just to get them in the seat. And so there's still a lot of that. But there was improvement, and hopefully that's where the industry is going to go. They're going to continue to improve on that. Certainly, like you had stated, the use of electronics is here to stay, and there are a lot of them. And, you know, just on a personal note, doing some ladder training the past couple weeks, doing a ladder class, and to have a $1.2 million piece of new life-saving equipment grounded by a $5 sensor and the truck wouldn't work, I take great pause with that and really wonder with some of this where it's going to go, to think that you could ground a million-dollar-plus truck that's on a life-saving mission and with a $5 or $10 sensor just seems incredulous to me that we're doing that. I don't know where it's going to go, but certainly, like you said, it's here to stay, but we need to do a better job with that industry-wide as well.
Yeah, I just to wrap up on this, Mike, I think the industry, however they're getting the feedback, I think that they're listening to folks. I agree. One of the more common things is no matter how much room you put in a cab, the commentary will come back, it ain't enough. So they're looking to do, you know, some improvements there. As we've talked about, you know, we've just about reached the practical limit of how wide you can make a fire truck and get it around town, no matter how much space you may or may not have, you know, in your fire station. So we're now really, you know, from a pragmatic standpoint, we're working within some practical limits. The other week when we were, you know, just kicking around things and talking about, you know, the physical size of fire trucks over the years, when you think about that, way back in the day, a fire truck cab on the inside measured 72 inches across, and now the inside width is typically, you know, 80, 84 to 88, and our overall width on the cab is anywhere from 94 to 100 inches. We just we can't go a whole heck of a lot bigger and think that it's, you know, going to go anywhere, much less worry about fitting in the fire station. So, well, that's it for today's podcast. Again, we're real happy to be back here. Happy to be working once again with Pete Matthews. Going to be talking about more topical things here as we go along in each podcast for the succeeding month. And again, once again, just like to plug the fact, Firehouse Expo coming up in Baltimore, July 17, 18, and 19. The now retired Lieutenant Wilbur, Tom Shan, and a host of other fire service notables that are way ahead of us in terms of when you underline the word notable, are going to be there to instruct some of the best firefighters in the country. So we look forward to seeing you.
And again, for Mike Wilber, Tom Sandy, Apparatus Architects, until the next time, take care and be safe.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.